Today is Wednesday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Instances of the COVID-19 coronavirus approaches 200,000.
The World Health Organization is urging governments to implement a comprehensive, aggressive approach.
Plus reports of abuse faced by migrants and asylum seekers.
Tear gas was being fired and water cannons and firearms. And what we found after interviewing refugees that they had uniformly experienced pretty grave abuses.
Those stories and more are next. The World Health Organization says the coronavirus has reached 159 countries with more than 185 confirmed cases and 7,500 deaths. In the United States, about 7 million people in San Francisco have been told to shelter in place. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said he will decide by Thursday whether to institute a similar order for the country's most populous city. The WHO is urging governments to implement a comprehensive, aggressive approach in tackling COVID-19 to slow down the rapidly increasing number of cases and deaths from this dangerous new virus in Europe and other parts of the world. Lisa Schlein starts us off with this update.
The largest number of cases and deaths from coronavirus are still being reported from the Western Pacific region, which includes China. But Europe is running a close second and now has a larger cumulative number of confirmed infections and deaths than all other regions combined. The World Health Organization says it is difficult to nail down any one factor or particular scenario behind the surge of cases in Europe. WHO spokesman Christian Lindmeier tells VOA his agency has been warning for weeks that this novel virus would grab hold and continue spreading with relentless speed around the world.
At the same time, when you have a large spike of cases, either because they have been undetected for a while or because of an unfortunate incident where a large group of people gets infected at one time, then you reach capacity problems. And this is what many European countries seem to be struggling right now.
Lindmeier explains many countries were unprepared to test, treat, and track those infected when the virus struck. He says many still lack the capacity to implement these important measures. He says the lack of medical equipment, tests, personnel, hospital beds, ventilators, and other essential items is a global problem. A growing number of countries are resorting to draconian measures such as self-isolation, social distancing, and travel bans to curb the spread of COVID-19. Lindemeyer says government authorities have to decide for themselves on the policies they believe will work best for their societies. But he notes both China and Singapore, which employed very strict medical, social, and political measures, have seen dramatic declines in coronavirus cases and deaths.
The examples we've seen so far show us that drastic cuts or drastic limitations in the social life of a population, together with an aggressive testing, tracking, and treating of patients and their contacts, has worked.
WHO spokesman Lindmeier says it is too early to know whether the drastic measures being employed by Italy, Spain, France, Switzerland, and other countries are paying off. He says the global pandemic will get worse before it gets better. He warns people will have to brace themselves for many more infections and deaths before the pandemic peaks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Donald Trump on Wednesday announced the closure of the U.S.-Canada border, underlining that trade will not be affected. The shutdown builds on Trump's barring of visitors from most of Europe, China, and other parts of the world hit by the coronavirus. Now, to address some of those concerns about the COVID-19, I spoke with Dr. Runjun Misra.
These measures that we're implementing right now, they're all modeled based on science and based on history. And these aren't measures that we're just arbitrarily just taking into consideration. But what we need to understand is when we say social distancing, or now a lot of the states are mandating that we stay in the house and we shelter at home, like California is, for example, the reason for that is you're not only protecting yourself, number one, as an individual, but also protecting those around you. And they are the most effective measures that we can put in place to decrease the spread of the virus. because if you're not out there, and at this time, given you know, the lag that we have with testing, we're telling people to behave as though they're positive. So I don't know if I'm positive, but I can definitely act like I'm positive and keep myself away from everyone, because we just, you know, we haven't had that testing to be able to test everyone and find the sources and trace back to all the people they've exposed during you know, while they've been out in public. And so this is the best measure that we can take, whereas just keep everyone away from everyone else, minimize contact and minimize that spread.
What if you can't stay away from anyone else? And to that, I mean, you know, there are refugee camps, there are asylum seekers who don't have a place to shelter in place. They're in close quarters without really knowing where the disease is in terms of their exact location, whether or not it will be there. What can an individual do if they are, you know, left with no other option but to be around other people?
Right. And of course, that's so very unfortunate to hear. And I, and it's part of our reality also at the same time. But if you don't have an option, then as much as you can, we'd recommend to practice social distancing, which is keep a distance of 6 feet away from you and other people. And all of us must do this together, because I know from personal experience, when I try to go out just to get the essentials, or I need something at the grocery store, I'm trying to maintain, you know, that 6 feet distance from people, but people are still, you know, lining up right behind me. And that's not really that helpful, because I'm trying to do my part. Unless we all do our individual part, it's not going to work. And so when you are in close quarters with someone, you need to try to maintain that distance to as much as you can. Obviously, if the space is not accommodating, then you need to maintain 3 feet. Maintain whatever distance you can, given the restraints of your space. And if you're sick, then try to isolate yourself, and obviously still maintain very stringent hygiene practices, where you're washing your hands, where you're using disinfectant, and cleaning counters that are in high traffic areas, and other things like doorknobs and light switches, and just maintaining whatever you know, practice of hygiene that you can, given your resources.
Runjun Misra is an internal medicine physician in San Francisco. Epidemiologist Dr. Elizabeth Radin of Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health explains that holding your breath is not a good way to determine if you have COVID-19.
I think the theory there is that you could try to detect if you have some sort of irritation or diminished capacity in your lungs. Even if these strategies were a way to detect something about lung capacity or lung irritation, you'd really have no way of knowing if the cause was COVID-19 or if the cause was a cold or the flu or even something like seasonal allergies. So those are not ways that we can test for COVID-19. The only way to know is if you have the laboratory test that is specifically made to detect COVID-19. The type of tests that are available at the moment basically work by identifying the unique genetic material of the virus. So they've taken that genome of the virus, and the test looks for unique sequences that can say, yes, we've actually detected the genetic material of the virus in you, and therefore you have COVID-19. Another type of test that is under development is called a serological test. And that's a test that would detect antibodies to the virus. So that test is looking to see if your immune system is responding or has responded to having the virus. That's an important test because it would tell us not just who is currently infected with the virus, but it would let us know something about people with past infections, and would really help answer this question about what portion of the population might have mild symptoms or even no symptoms at all. I think the most important guidance that we can give across the board at this point is that you don't want to expose other people to any kind of illness, in particular COVID-19, by going around seeking a test. If you have the top symptoms for COVID-19, which are fever, dry cough, and shortness of breath, you can seek information, whether that's by calling your doctor or visiting a local website, about the availability of the test. If it's not readily available, the most important step is to stay at home, to isolate yourself from others, to even distance yourself from people in your own household, and to, if you're experiencing severe symptoms that would normally send you to a hospital, to seek medical care.
Dr. Elizabeth Radin is with Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Amazon.com will only receive vital supplies at its U.S. and European warehouses until April 5th. That's the latest move to free up inventory space for medical and household goods in high demand as a result of the coronavirus outbreak. That follows an announcement on Monday that the online retailer would hire 100,000 warehouse and delivery workers in the United States to deal with a surge in online orders. Investor worries about the economic effects of the novel coronavirus outbreak continue to weigh on global markets. Major markets in Asia traded in positive territory for much of the day, but plunged later to close with losses. Japan's Nikkei and Shanghai index finished down almost 2%, while Hong Kong's Hang Seng index was down 4%. Major indices in Europe fell by about 4%, and U.S. trading got off to a rocky start. Benchmark WTI oil slumped to its lowest level since 2003 to just above $25 a barrel as the coronavirus slashes global demand for crude. For additional coronavirus information from around the world, visit voanews.com. China has effectively ordered American journalists at the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal to leave the country in the communist government's most severe move against foreign media in recent memory. The foreign ministry said the measure was in retaliation for Washington's decision to cut the number of Chinese nationals allowed to work for Chinese state-run media on American soil. Starting Wednesday, the journalists, whose press cards were due to expire later this year, must notify the foreign ministry within 4 days and hand back their credentials within 10 days. In a statement, VOA's management said it stood with the affected news organizations and said the agency remains committed to our work in China and condemn attempts to curtail it. Chinese authorities also announced moves that will curtail U.S. journalists, including those from The Voice of America, from operating inside China. Still to come.
Everything, all challenges right now. I want to emphasize this, that we're entering a new age of American politics.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that the Earth's magnetic fields are generated deep in our planet's core. A series of three new studies supports another theory, which proposes that early in our planet's history, the magnetic field may have been generated instead by a then-hot liquid portion of the Earth's mantle. While our planet's core is composed of mostly iron and some nickel, the mantle is made up of silicate material, which scientists say is usually a poor electrical conductor. One study from UCLA geophysicist Lars Stixrud suggests that electrical conductivity within the liquid silicate material was large enough to maintain a dynamo that could generate a magnetic field. Researchers from the University of California, San Diego, conducted computer simulations that found electrical conductivity of the hot liquid lower mantle exceeds the threshold needed for magnetic field generating dynamo activity. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Human Rights Watch organization accused Greek security forces of abusing migrants and asylum seekers trying to enter from Turkey. The allegations include physical beatings and the use of tear gas and water cannons. The group said Greek authorities are violating people's basic right to seek asylum. Speaking from her home in Beirut, Lebanon, Human Rights Watch researcher Nadia Hardman, who helped investigate the abuses at the Greek border, explained them to VOA's Jason Patinkin.
So we spent some time in the first week of March following Turkey's decision to basically stop preventing people crossing into Greece. We went there to basically try and understand what was happening, because we could see on the media reports that tear gas was being fired and water cannons and firearms. And what we found after interviewing refugees all along the Greece-Turkey border in this province called Edirne, in northern Turkey that they had uniformly experienced pretty grave abuses whilst trying to cross into Greece by Greek security forces. And this ranged from beatings, being forced to strip naked or down to their underwear, being held in effectively incommunicado houses on the Greek side, and then being summarily pushed back into Turkey and not being allowed to claim the right to asylum, which so many of them wanted to do.
And so the people doing this, committing these abuses, these were apparently, you know, Greek police, Greek border guards. Who exactly was doing this?
We interviewed many refugees who consistently described people wearing military fatigues or police uniforms and identifying themselves as Greek security forces. We also heard allegations that there were other unidentified men present wearing all in black uniforms with balaclavas. We understand that Frontex, which is the European border agency, sent reinforcements to the border. And so we have also written to Frontex to understand if they are aware of the abuses that we're very sure that the Greek security forces have been involved in, but have concerns that Frontex might also be involved in these abuses as well.
Have the Greek authorities responded in any way, or have they explained what's going on?
The Greek response has generally been one of denial. At the same time, there has been a sort of proud recognition to marshal the border. But their response has been one of pride, frankly, that this is a way to keep irregular migration out rather than uphold their duty to respect the right to asylum, which they have accepted because they are part of the EU. And the EU has also supported Greece in its rhetoric by, you know, praising these actions as a shield against, you know, irregular migration into the EU. Of course, Greece has the right to control its borders, but it should be done in a manner which is humane, and people should not be sent back to a place where they fear, you know, serious harm or abuse. And that is simply just not happening right now in Greece. They are just summarily pushing people trying to claim asylum back. And the EU, instead of calling this out in a way that aligns with its own democratic principles and rights-based values, has been woefully inadequate in stepping up and demonstrating that they will hold Greece to account if this does not stop.
That was Nadia Hardman with Human Rights Watch. She's a researcher there. She spoke to VOA's Jason Patinkin. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden swept to a convincing win in Tuesday's Democratic presidential primaries in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona over U.S. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. With nearly all of the vote counted in Florida, the southeastern state that is the adopted home of Republican President Donald Trump, Biden was beating Sanders 62-23%. The margin was similar in Illinois and slightly closer in Arizona. With the wins on Tuesday, Biden, in his third run for the presidency over three decades, has won 19 of the last 24 state primaries. His remaining primary rival is Bernie Sanders, a self-declared Democratic socialist who has vowed to lead a social and economic revolution, including a massive overhaul of the U.S. healthcare system. To see how the race for the White House now stands as Americans face the novel coronavirus pandemic, I spoke with Craig Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University.
Well, I think that early on right now, it's helping the Democrats increase potential leverage over Donald Trump. The nation has been pretty harsh to criticize the slow response from the White House and lack of action and kind of the downplaying of the virus. So I think early on in this crisis, it's going to benefit the Democrats, and particularly Joe Biden. However, because of how early in the election cycle this pandemic has happened, I think President Trump does have plenty of time to rebound and to take it more seriously and to put in some effective emergency measures. And so he could actually massage this to help him the longer the pandemic plays out and the more response or the heavier the response is that the federal government comes in to play. So right now, I think it's benefiting the Democrats, but I think in the long term, it will actually benefit President Trump more as he increases federal relief to people in need.
What about the economy?
Good questions. I think actually the election could hinge on what happens with the national economy. Again, it's pretty early. So the decreases and the losses in the stock market, at least, I think, can potentially rebound, though probably not as high as what they were through the highest of the Trump administration. I think you're absolutely right. The election hinges on this. If the economy keeps staggering, I think you can look for Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, to beat and surpass Trump. I think if Trump manages it at a healthy rate and explains away the losses, that he could maintain leverage, however. So it's up to his messaging game, which the president is pretty good at. He knows how to reach his base and his voters. So I think it's up to the narrative he provides. But if the economy continues to tank and we don't see some type of stabilization or a little bit of an increase in the stock market, and there's no federal relief to people in need, to people being laid off, you know, the idea is that it might get to a 20% temporary unemployment rate. If that happens or anything near that, I don't think Trump has stands a chance for reelection.
Speaking of getting the message out, President Trump, beginning back in 2016, held these massive rallies and has continued up until the pandemic really got worse here in the United States. Joe Biden also has canceled rallies. What challenges face the candidates running for the Oval Office now that large-scale rallies really are a thing of the past?
Everything, all challenges right now. I want to emphasize this, that we're entering a new age of American politics. This pandemic is really forcing the campaign season to take on a brand new tone, brand new narrative. Everything that we're seeing going digital, canceling all these rallies, how voting may occur. We may be forced in the remaining primary states for mailing ballots only. And who knows how that affects the general election and how long this pandemic lasts might affect what we do for the general election. So I think we're seeing major consequences for the entire way campaigns and elections happen, where we may see a full digital onslaught for what campaigning and marketing oneself for a nomination might look like. It might be going fully online almost. And so we'll see the complete digitization of the American election cycle, which is something that some have been forecasting for a while, but this might be what brings it into actualization.
That was Craig Albert, a political science professor with Augusta University. China and Cambodia bucked the global trend of event cancellations this week by starting joint military exercises as a way to show the world they're over the coronavirus outbreak and getting friendlier despite apprehension in other countries. Ellen Chong, associate professor at the S. Rajah Ratnam School of International Studies in Singapore, says the exercises are a way of China saying that things are getting back to normal.
I think China wants to put the COVID-19 virus behind it. There's every reason to shore up regime legitimacy as soon as possible.
China and Cambodia are holding their own Dragon Gold 2020 drills amid a global wave of event cancellations to stop the spread of COVID-19. Officials in Beijing hope to show the world they are re-emerging now politically and economically after the outbreak, which is still spreading in Western countries. The China-Cambodia exercises show China's commitment to fracturing ASEAN as an institution, says Stephen Nagy, a senior associate professor of politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo.
By inculcating itself into Cambodia through joint missions or joint tests or the establishment of a base, this is a very, very effective way to prevent ASEAN working as it's supposed to.
The Sino-Cambodian drills come after the U.S.-led multi-country Cobra Gold military exercises hosted by Thailand ended March 6th. China resents U.S. naval movement in the South China Sea. The U.S. and other countries consider the waterway public, while China claims about 90% as its own. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team in Washington, thank you very much for spending part of your day with the Voice of America. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have an absolutely fantastic day.